We're going to be in 1 Corinthians chapter 6 this morning. If you remember, we didn't quite get through chapter 5 last time. I don't want to get too bogged down there, but there are a couple of matters we need to at least touch on in chapter 5 as that's wrapping up before we get into chapter 6. First Corinthians chapter 5, the last paragraph there, verses 9 through 13, where Paul speaks about what he has written, and what seems to be their misunderstanding of it or a further clarification of it. Really, the point of all of that is to say who I'm talking about when I say these things aren't people outside the church. You don't need to worry about judging those people. God's going to take care of that. You need to worry about the people who are in your midst and not associating with those kinds of people if they are sexually immoral, verse 9, or verse 10, greedy and swindlers, idolaters, verse 11, revilers, drunkards, don't even eat with such a one. And then he goes on to clarify who I'm talking about are the people who are supposed to be Christians. If they're acting that way, you don't associate yourself with those people. And the significance of that paragraph within the larger context of chapter 5 that we were talking about last week is that this is exactly what they're not doing. They have people who are acting this way, and rather than treating it properly and dealing with the situation within the church and disassociating themselves from them, they're being proud about it, they're boasting about it, all those kinds of things that, again, we talked about last week. And so they're not doing what they are supposed to be doing in regard to that. Now, the one question that comes up in relation to all of that is, what exactly does it mean to not even eat with such a person? And one of the interesting things when you look at through the Bible and you look for this phrase, eating with someone, it is always, as far as I can tell at least, used in the context of eating at their table the food that they have prepared. It's not some broad statement that we might think of in our cultural context, where if you are in the same building with that person, you are technically eating with them. That's not what Paul's talking about. That, you know, every time you go to McDonald's, you need to take a survey of all of the patrons and find out if they've ever been withdrawn from a church because you can't eat with that person. Obviously, that's an absurd application of this text. But even it's more specific than, you know, if you're having a potluck of the brethren after an assembly, and someone who has been disciplined from the congregation shows up with a big platter of chicken, what do you do? Do you say, all right, break it up, everybody, time to go home, we can't eat with this person? Because, you know, if they sit down at the same table as me, I'm eating with them. I don't even think that's the point, because, you know, when Jesus ate with Levi, he ate the food that Levi prepared in his house. When he ate with a Pharisee in Luke 7, it's when he went to that person's house. When we commune with Christ, we are partaking of his supper at the Lord's table, and on down the line we could go. And so what you would do with that brother who shows up with his platter of fried chicken at your potluck, I don't think there's a need to just break everything up and send everybody home. So much as you don't eat with him, which is to say you don't eat the food that he's prepared. You leave his platter of food exactly as it is. You can't prevent him from eating with you, but you don't have to eat with him. And that would even, I think, show further the significance than, you know, everybody running in opposite directions to treat them with some kind of respect, yet not show the fellowship that you don't have with that person anymore. Shane?
Well, when you think about it, something wrong with our relationship. You're not living your life in such a way. And that if we have association with those people, that needs to be the conversation that we have with them. You know, are you ready to get your life right? What are you doing to get your life right? They need to understand that when they're in your presence, that's the conversation that you're going to have. If you associate with me at this point, we're going to talk about your spiritual condition in love, hoping that you will come back, not in a punishing, you know, exile. You're unclean. You're less of a person than I am. That type of thing. And that's sometimes where we get the line blurred. Is how we what the purpose is and how we're supposed to treat these people.
Yeah, and really, there's kind of it's kind of a twofold purpose for the person. Obviously, it's the discipline is intended to bring them back. The same kind of thing that you give medicine to a sick person to make them well, which I think also kind of indicates when discipline needs to happen before they are spiritually dead. Otherwise, the medicine's not going to help them. But then also for the congregation, the purpose of the discipline is so that the church isn't defiled by what they're doing. And that's what Paul goes on to talk about after that. You know, the little leaven leavens the whole lump. You've got to get them out of your midst or it's going to just ruin the entire body. Anything else about these verses here before we move on to chapter 6?
Well, what's implied in this whole chapter is that a person would care enough about the relationship they have with these other Christians that if it's removed from them, that they care about that instead of just, I think what happens in so many cases I've known about, the relationship never really existed or it deteriorated to such a point, they could care less whether they got a letter saying, oh, we're not having any association with you because they haven't had any association anyway.
Right.
And so it really says more about what kind of relationships we ought to have together. And then if a person is wayward, you know, and you might think of it more like, you know, the church is supposed to be a family. And hopefully in blood families, we do have those kind of relationships where, you know, people would care about, you know, being an outcast in their own family, that kind of thing. We could engender that same kind. That's clearly what underlies all of that.
I appreciate what Tom said. What happens, it's kind of frustrating. I have no authority on anything. It's certainly not on it. But it's, you have no relationship. And I've certainly seen men in business meetings get all upset about somebody that we haven't withdrawn from yet. And I give them, it'll aggravate that. How long has it been since you've ever been with this person outside of seeing them when they walk in the door to whenever the church gathers? And they never had. They never did have a relationship. They don't have anything to bring.
Yeah.
And so it does. It says a lot about what kind of relationship we have in the beginning. And then also, I think that a big fault. Deceased for several years, but up in Danville, Kentucky was a place a lot of preachers went through, were taught in a church up there. And he was telling a group of wannabe young men who wanted to be preachers, he was telling them about an elder. As a matter of fact, it was a personal friend. The man's wife were personal friends. And he was telling this, he said, now I'm telling this after the fact, so I can tell you what the man himself said. He got his pride hurt in a business meeting, and I don't know the particulars, I don't need to know, but he got his pride hurt, and he got mad, and the next thing you know, a man who'd been faithful for 35, 40 years wasn't attending services, and they withdrew from him. His wife said, I've got certain obligations with you. And so there's certain things I'll do, and even when it came to meals, she'd cook for him, but she wouldn't eat with him. And they went walks regularly on Sunday afternoons, and she wouldn't walk with him anymore. He told about the park where they walked every Sunday. He wouldn't do it anymore. And Brother Ellis said the man himself told him, said, it only took me about 3 weeks once my wife would have anything to do with me. He went before the church and he said, I was just a fool. He said, I was just a proud, arrogant fool. He said, I got my feelings hurt and I let it go too far. Well, I'm just telling that story to say, a lot of times the people that have the greatest effect on the person who's lost, they make all kinds of excuses for not breaking the ties. Why? Because you love them. I mean, and so you don't, the people who can be the most, have the most effect, positive effect, a lot of times are the last ones that will do anything. And those that get all worked up in the business meetings are men who never had anything to do with people anyway.
All right. Well, we'll go ahead and leave chapter 5 with that and move on to chapter 6. And chapters 5 and 6 are clearly a unit of thought. The way that they're organized seems to suggest that. There seems to be a pretty clear construction organization of what Paul is doing. What exactly this means is a little bit harder to figure out, but it begins and ends with a discussion of sexual immorality, two different types. First, this person who has his father's wife, and then it ends with a more general discussion of sexual immorality in chapter 6. Next, there are two lists of unrighteousness, verses 9 through 11 in both chapters, coincidentally enough, and they're basically the same list. There's a slight difference between them. And then the middle section is the beginning of chapter 6, maybe the end of chapter 5 as well, that's talking about judgment and lawsuits. Those last few verses of chapter 5 can obviously go with either one. Maybe it's just kind of a good segue transition thought between them. Now, the significance of this structure is hard to say exactly what it means, other than that it shows us a concise unit of thought what's going on here. It does at least roughly parallel the works of the flesh that Paul talks about in Galatians chapter 5, that begins with a discussion of flesh-driven kinds of sins and ends with a discussion of flesh-driven kinds of sins. And in the middle, there is this section of self-driven, ego-driven, personal, strife-driven kinds of sins. And so this kind of fits that same pattern. Maybe that's what Paul's up to in these two chapters, is kind of unpacking that other list with more specific details about what's going on specifically in Corinth. If that's not why it's organized this way, I have no idea why it is, but there is that at least to start with, to see that that's there. Well, let's go ahead and read verses 1 through 8 to start. When one of you has a grievance against another, does he dare go to law before the unrighteous instead of the saints? Or do you not know that the saints will judge the world? And if the world is to be judged by you, are you incompetent to try trivial cases? Do you not know that we are to judge angels? How much more, then, matters pertaining to this life? So if you have such cases, why do you lay them before those who have no standing in the church? I say this to your shame. Can it be that there is no one among you wise enough to settle a dispute between the brothers? But brother goes to law against brother, and that before unbelievers. To have lawsuits at all with one another is already a defeat for you. Why not rather suffer wrong? Why not rather be defrauded? But you yourselves wrong and defraud, even your own brothers. And so there are these lawsuits going on there in Corinth, of some kind at least. And really, it's a pretty simple section of text. We'll come back and talk about some of the specifics. But basically, the problem here is that there is this infighting, the same kind of infighting we've seen already. Here it's infighting specified within by lawsuits against one another in the congregation. And this kind of infighting going on in the church will shame the church before the world. The world sees this kind of stuff going on among people who are supposed to have as their distinguishing characteristic, according to Jesus, love for one another. This is going on instead. What does that tell the world about who we really are? And really, then, that goes on to show that the problem is a lack of Christ-likeness. When he goes on to say at the end of this section, you should suffer wrong, you should be defrauded, but instead you're doing the opposite of that, what he's saying is you're not being like Christ. Because that's what Christ did. He suffered wrong. He was defrauded. He accepted that as his lot, and that's what he calls his followers to as well. How many times does he say, suffer like I suffer, take your cross? Peter talks about that same kind of thing, be like Christ, who when he was reviled did not revile in return, and so forth. And so the problem is they're not being like Christ. On top of that, there's another problem that kind of runs through this entire chapter, and that is lack of knowledge, lack of understanding. Six times in this short chapter, he will say, do you not know such and such? Which clearly indicates this is something they were supposed to know. And they're not acting right, they're not living right, because they don't know what they are supposed to know. Or at least they're not applying what they do know. And so there's this lack of understanding as well. Well, the solution is quite simple as well. What he says, first of all, is if you have this problem, don't go to someone outside the church who is an unrighteous person. Go to a brother and let the brother arbitrate between you. Let that be the solution. That's what he says in verse 5. However, beyond that, what he says is even better than that. You should have a sacrificial giving spirit toward others. This is the more excellent way. This is the way of Christ. So in summation, there are really two points to the solution here. First, Christian cases should be tried in quote-unquote Christian courts. Second, there shouldn't be any Christian cases to begin with. And that really should be the ultimate solution to this matter. You act like Christ in this regard, and it's going to solve all of your problems. You won't have to worry about who's solving your cases, because there won't be any cases to begin with. Well, a couple of other things here in this chapter that are in this section that are interesting to consider, probably need a little bit more discussion. First, he says, don't you know that the saints will judge the world? This is almost certainly rooted in Daniel 7, where the Ancient of Days has come and given authority to the Son of Man, and the saints judge with him. It's the same kind of picture that you see in Matthew 19, where Jesus tells the apostles they'll sit on 12 thrones and judge the 12 tribes. In Revelation 20, where the glorified saints reign with Christ. That's the kind of idea that this is coming from. The saints are going to judge the world. The next verse is even more surprising, at least it is to me. Don't you know that we are to judge angels? And what's surprising to me about that, at least every time I read it, I might be the only one here who hasn't picked up on this before somehow, is I read that, and obviously Paul's saying, you should know this, people. You're going to judge angels. And I'm thinking, where in my life, in anything in the Bible, have I ever gotten the idea that I was supposed to judge angels? If this verse wasn't here, I don't think I would have ever come to that conclusion on my own. Maybe it's something Paul told them specifically when he was at Corinth. Maybe it was something they were supposed to figure out otherwise, but apparently they were supposed to know it. And one thing that might suggest that is back in chapter 4 in verse 9, he says, I think that God has exhibited us apostles as last of all, like men sentenced to death, because we have become a spectacle to the world, to angels and to men. And so here the word world is clearly used to describe not just the physical world, not just the planet Earth, not even just sinful mankind, as the world very often does, like in 1 John, don't love the things of the world, or it does throughout the Gospel of John, that the world is the sinful part of the world. And it's not even just all people on the world, but here the world is all of created reality, angels and man, everything intelligent that God has created. And so if you understand properly that that's the world, at least in some contexts, not every context, but at least in some contexts, that's the world, and we are going to judge the world, then that includes angels along the way. And if that's not how Paul was getting to this conclusion, I have no idea, unless it's by special revelation God has told that to him. But again, maybe I've just missed something. But the ultimate significance of all of this is both points. If you're going to be such a high judge in the sight of God, you're going to judge sinful man, you're going to judge angels, why is it that you can't judge matters amongst yourself? Why can't you take care of your own problems? Why do you have to take it before courts of unrighteous, sinful pagan people and let them answer your questions? You air your dirty laundry before them, and again, you shame the church before the world. And then in what is probably the most biting sarcasm in the whole book, we've already seen some sarcasm in 1 Corinthians, Probably what is the most biting of all of it is in verse 5, I say this to your shame. Can it be that there is no one among you wise enough to settle a dispute? Here is the church, if you remember, we've been talking about it in the first few chapters, the way Paul was dealing with wisdom. It seemed clear that they have some kind of obsession with wisdom. Wisdom is the answer to everything. We're so wise. We're so intelligent. And they were very proud in the wisdom that they had. Now Paul comes up and says, here's a chance for you to show some wisdom, and you have no idea what you're doing. Isn't there just one person there in the entire congregation that's obsessed with wisdom who is wise enough to handle this on your own that you have to take it to someone else? And then he says, you know, I say this to your shame, which is a stark contrast from what he said back in chapter 4, where he says, I don't write these things to make you ashamed, where he had been sarcastic previously. He says, I'm trying to exhort you as a father. Here he is trying to shame them a little bit with this. Greg? Oh, yeah, I think you're right. The point ultimately is that they need to solve the problem themselves. They shouldn't be taken out there. It's this kind of infighting that we've seen already. But yeah, ultimately, the result of that, by going to these people, by showing this kind of attitude to them, by airing your dirty laundry in front of them, it will shame the church. It will shame Christians before them. But the main problem is their strife amongst themselves. I think you're absolutely right about that. Yes, sir.
20 or 30 years ago, I heard of a true story where two brethren went before an unbelieving judge. He read this scripture to them and shamed them right there in court, said, you have no business being here.
I don't think that would happen anymore. Yeah, that's what needs to be done. It needs to be handled among us. And again, ultimately, it needs to be handled among us, not by having to have a trial here, but by people having the right kind of attitude to begin with. Yes, sir.
So I went up with a summons and had to go to court. When we got there, the judge had this particular passage opened up, and he wanted to know why were we there, that this was just, if I'm understanding what you teach, you're not supposed to be here. Why are you dragging me into this? And he dismissed the case and said, I'll not get involved in it. You have other rules to take care of it. And that was probably about the same time. And you might not find that judge today, but he was there. This was in a different state. But it was very refreshing to hear the judge of the civil law saying, you got a law. Take care of it.
Troy?
Sometimes the Roman people did the same thing when the Jews brought complaints.
Yeah.
You know, they're like, you handle them yourself. It's none of our business.
Yeah, isn't that what Pilate basically says? Yeah. All right, anything else on these first eight verses? Anyone want to explain to me how we're supposed to figure out that we're going to judge angels? Okay.
Can we sue angels?
Well, if we're going to judge them, then. All right, well, verses 9 through 11 is the section on unrighteousness then. Do you not know that the unrighteous will not inherit the kingdom of God? Do not be deceived, neither the sexually immoral, nor idolaters, nor adulterers, nor men who practice homosexuality, nor thieves, nor the greedy, nor drunkards, nor revilers, nor swindlers will inherit the kingdom of God. And such were some of you, but you were washed, you were sanctified, you were justified in the name of the Lord Jesus Christ by the Spirit of our God. Well, there is this section again, and again it parallels chapter 5, which kind of brackets this section. Is all of it being about this kind of unrighteousness. Both lists end with revilers and swindlers, and I can't help but wonder if that's kind of what led Paul into thinking about them suing each other, although that might be a little bit too much of a stretch. There are a few different elements from this list than the one in chapter 5. Adulterers is added, and that would, of course, directly address the problem in chapter 5 and point forward to the problem in chapter 6 as well, verses 12 through 20. And then also there are two words that are translated by one phrase in the translation I'm reading from, men who practice homosexuality. There are two different words that refer to the active and passive partner in a homosexual relationship. And both of those words are there, and your translation may do something different with that, but those words are there as well. And then if I remember correctly, and I might be wrong about this, is the word idolaters different here than in chapter 5? That's something that I think I remember. I should have written it down, I guess. Is it the same word? Well, the picture of idolatry, either way, the picture of idolatry in these lists, especially in the context of sexual immorality, it's probably not just idolatry in the Old Testament sense of bowing down to images, although that would be included, obviously, but in the context of Corinth, where you had cult prostitutes and a lot of sexual immorality wrapped up in the worship of other gods, that's probably what is more specifically in mind, especially in this context of sexual immorality as well. And really, what we find in these two lists is something of a foundational principle that is controlling the direction that Paul's going, is what stands behind everything that he's saying through these two chapters. And what it is that the church consists of cleansed people. That's what he goes on to say. You were washed, you were sanctified, you were justified in the name of the Lord Jesus Christ. You've been cleansed from these things. Such were some of you. You're not that way anymore. The church consists of cleansed people, and so you need to stay that way. You can't go back to these kinds of things if you've been cleansed from them. Otherwise, obviously, you're not very much cleansed anymore. And then also that phrase, such were some of you. You go through this list, and these are the kind of eyebrow-raising sins in our culture, at least the worst of the worst. You know, we say and we believe on some level, at least, all sins are equal in the sight of God. Any sin will send you to hell, just like any other sin. But then there are other sins that still kind of make you stop and say, "Oh wow, someone's actually doing that." And I don't want to say that we have a double standard, but that's just kind of a natural reaction. Well, this is that list. These are the things that, you know, make us stop and really raise our eyebrows. And what Paul says is, you were these kinds of people. You did these kinds of things, but in spite of how terrible your sins were, you have been cleansed from them, and you're not in bondage to them anymore, and so you must not be in bondage to them after this point. And it also shows, you know, we look around the world and we say, what hope does the gospel have in a wicked world like this that we live in now? Well, such were some of you, Paul says, and they were changed. It's not like, you know, the first century preachers were greeted by, you know, just millions of people running to them saying, I want to change my life and not be in bondage to sin anymore. You know, we're the one generation of people in the history of the world who isn't really in bondage to sin. No, they were. And they lived in an incredibly decadent, amoral society that did terrible things, and they were involved in it as well. And the fact that Paul says this about them shows that, you know, it wasn't they had the most promising material for these early preachers. They had people of the same low standards that we have today, and what it required was the power of the gospel to change them. And the same thing is absolutely true today. people who do the same things and act the same way and are in slavery to the same sins, they can be washed and sanctified and justified just as well as people back then could have. We could very easily look at a room of people and say, such were some of you, but you've changed. And what it takes is the same thing now, and that is the power of the gospel. And it takes people who will take that gospel to them. We've said before, how can we be the salt of the world if we sit here in our little salt shaker and never get out and do any salting? That's what it takes to change these kinds of people. No less is required of us today than was required of them in that day. And it's not like the deck is stacked against us because the world's so terrible now. It was just as bad then as it is now. Or anything else about these verses before we get to the verses 12 through 20 and try to get through this chapter today? Brian?
It almost seems like there's a big jump of thought there in chapter 6, like you have verses 1 through 8 dealing with the lawsuits, and then all of a sudden we deal with the unrighteousness, 9 through 11. But isn't there perhaps a segue of thought there in that he's at the end of the section about lawsuits, he's making the contrast between the unrighteous and them? And so then he continues with that contrast by saying, hey, this is what the unrighteous are like. And then he does say at the end of that, you used to be this way.
Yeah.
And it's because of that contrast between them. He's saying, don't take your lawsuits in front of these unrighteous.
Yeah, I think that makes sense.
Okay.
Anything else? All right, well, on to verses 12 through 20 then. All things are lawful for me, but not all things are helpful. All things are lawful for me, but I will not be enslaved by anything. Food is meant for the stomach, and the stomach for food, and God will destroy both the one and the other. The body is not meant for sexual immorality, but for the Lord, and the Lord for the body. And God raised up the Lord, and will also raise us up by His power. Do you not know that your bodies are members of Christ? Shall I then take the members of Christ and make them members of a prostitute? Never. Or do not be joined. Do you not know? Or do you not know that he who is joined to a prostitute becomes one body with her? For as it is written, the two will become one flesh. But he who is joined to the Lord becomes one spirit with him. Flee from sexual immorality. Every other sin a person commits outside the body, but the sexually immoral person sins against his own body. Or do you not know that your body is a temple of the Holy Spirit within you, whom you have from God? You are not your own, for you were bought with a price. So glorify God in your body. Well, what's going on in this section, at the beginning at least, is Paul seems to be refuting the kinds of slogans that they go around saying. All things are lawful for me. Food's meant for the body, or for the stomach, and the stomach's meant for food. That the kinds of things that they were using to justify their sexual immorality. And it seems that that's what's going on, because every time Paul says one of these things, he immediately turns around and refutes it. So what he's going to do in this section is, first of all, he's going to attack their mistaken notions, and then he's going to address the specific problem and their misunderstanding about that, and then he will clarify one last time for emphasis, don't engage in this kind of behavior. So what's going on? He first will quote their little slogan, all things are lawful for me, and then he's going to refute that, correct it by saying, but no, not all things are helpful. He'll say, all things are lawful for me again. He'll repeat the same slogan and then say, no, I will not be enslaved to anything. And then he'll say, food is meant for the stomach and the stomach for food, and God will destroy both the one and the other. And then he will correct that by saying, no, the body is for the Lord. And we'll talk more about that specifically in just a second. So what he's doing is he's quoting them and then refuting what they're using as their justification for the kind of behavior that they are engaging in. Now, before we talk about that specifically, just to kind of run through this section, the point of all of it is don't engage in this kind of behavior. Don't engage in sexual immorality. Flee fornication will be the specific command in verse 18. But really, this entire section of text is just one reason after the other why you must not behave in this kind of way. First of all, he'll say in verse 14, we're raised people. You can't behave this way because God raised us up. God will raise us up. We are going to be resurrected. And so because of that, our bodies are for Christ. They're not our own. They're not for ourselves to indulge our own pleasures. They belong to the Lord. And then he'll go on to say that it's, or he'll say we are joined with the Lord. He'll say it's a sin against the body itself. It is in some regard different from other sins because it is a sin against the body in verse 18. Verse 19, God dwells in us, and so we can't behave this way. Verses 19 and 20, we're not our own. We were bought with a price, and so we can't behave this way. And then finally, what we are supposed to be doing with our body is glorifying God in it rather than glorifying ourselves or gratifying ourselves. And it's the same principle that you find in Romans 12 of offering yourself as a living sacrifice to God. And so really throughout this entire section, just one time after another, you find reason after reason after reason why you are not to be engaging in this sort of behavior. So, he begins with this little thing they have going around, all things are lawful. This was a very common slogan of the Stoics and the Cynics who liked to say this kind of thing. And it is always quoted by Paul with a nullifying, with a refuting qualifier. He doesn't quote it and let it stand by itself. He'll quote it again in chapter 10. We'll talk about that when we get there, obviously. But it is always quoted and then corrected immediately after. And specifically here, what he says is, all things are not profitable. They're not all profitable for you. They're definitely not all profitable for everyone else. So, you know, don't go around thinking all things are lawful because all things aren't profitable. And the second time he quotes it, he says, I will not be mastered by anything. You walk around saying all things are lawful as if it gives you some kind of liberty to do whatever you want to do. But the reality is when you engage in this kind of behavior, you're not exercising liberty. You're taking on a yoke of bondage. You're being mastered by something else. You're being ruled by something else. You're being enslaved to something else. And so you think you're being this free person, but really you're becoming a slave to something. Second, this quotation, food is for the stomach, and the stomach is for food, and all will be destroyed. The thinking is that the body and everything that pertains to it is going to be destroyed anyway, and so there's no religious importance to anything that involves the body. You can do whatever you want to. And so stomach and food will be destroyed. Why attach any kind of religious importance to it? Seems to be their line of thinking. And did I say thinking? Line of thinking. Thinking. I like that. I might have to use that again sometime. And so then by extension, if that's true of the stomach, if that's true of food, by application, that covers the entire body, and specifically it would cover sexual relations as well, would seem to be their thinking. And Paul says, no, that is absolutely not the case. And verse 14 is parallel to verse 13. In answering this. So they say food is for the stomach is for food, and God will destroy both this and these. Paul says, no, the body is for the Lord, and the Lord is for the body, and God has both raised up the Lord and will raise up us also through his power. And so structurally it's exactly the same. Phrase by phrase is nearly the same, except he's taking out what they've said and plugging in the truth, which is, no, the body is not for food, the body is for God. Food's not for the body. God is for the body. God is not going to destroy these things. God is going to raise up these things. And if you understand that, that solves the whole problem of the argument that they're trying to make. The body is not destined to be destroyed. It is destined to be transformed and glorified. And so God doesn't design the body for sexual immorality as he designed the stomach for food. The body is for the Lord. And if the body is for the Lord, then it can't be dismissed as unimportant. It's the instrument wherein we serve God, the means by which we glorify God. The body is for the Lord. And the Lord is for the body. Just as food is necessary for the stomach to function, so the Lord is necessary for the body to function. It's only as God enables us to live and to move and to have our being that we can live the kind of life for which we are meant. And ultimately, the point then is that the Lord's care for the body is manifest in the resurrection. And that is assured to us, it is guaranteed to us by the resurrection of the Lord himself. that when he raised Christ from the dead, he has given us assurance that he is going to raise us from the dead as well. And if it is a bodily resurrection, as the New Testament clearly teaches, then we can't just do whatever we want to with our body and think it's not going to matter. Because God is going to raise up that body. Yes, it's going to be a different body. It's going to be a changed body. It's going to be transformed into immortality, as Paul will say in chapter 15, but it is the body nonetheless. And that's the point that Paul is making here, and he'll make in 2 Corinthians as well, is that we must treat our bodies as holy vessels because God has shown such interest in it that he is going to raise it up at the last day. And it forbids that we take it lightly and think, well, the body's going to be destroyed anyway. We can do whatever we want to with it. No, that is absolutely not true, and the resurrection proves that that is not true. And that's the premise here is our bodies have been purchased by God. They've been purchased by the blood of Christ through His sacrifice. And God is going to take possession of those bodies when He resurrects them, when He raises them from the dead. And so we can't sin against our bodies because God cares so much about them. I'll stop for a second. Any questions or comments about any of this? Tom?
Paul's argument here is a little bit elliptical. He leaves out some of the, you know, he doesn't spell everything out for us. We could assume that our bodies belong to the Lord to begin with because He's the Creator. But one could argue, but God only intended our bodies to have a temporary purpose, and so God didn't care if they just kind of serve their purpose and we die and the body rots away and our real self, our spirit, goes and, you know, does its thing. But it's the resurrection that proves, no, God is reversing all of the curse of creation, which sin caused. Death, physical death, came in because of sin. So if God's fixing all of the consequences of sin, that includes reversal of death. And the fact that God raises the physical body of Jesus proves that God still cares about the body. He has a purpose for it. He is redeeming it. And if that's true, then we can't say, well, the body, like you said, it's not important. It really belongs to God, and I can only use it in keeping with His will and His purpose for it.
All right. Well, next couple weeks, we're going to be out of town. We're heading up to visit family in Ohio. Barry has generously agreed to cover the next couple weeks. If you want to be reading chapter, what are we up to now? Chapter 7. In preparation for that, he'll be taking care of that.